Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 11th of May. Going to have a lively first hour today as we look at Elena Kagan. We'll have three guests with us. One will make a case for Elena Kagan. Lawrence Lessig will join us, who has taught with her for some 20 years. He's a professor of law at Harvard Law School and co-founder of Change Congress. Later this hour, we'll speak with Professor Paul Campos from the University of Colorado, who wrote a piece in the New Republic, Blank Slate. There's a lot we don't know about Elena Kagan because she never told us. And the last part of our program, Sam Stein, political reporter for the Huffington Post, will talk about how this will play out politically and what kind of questions we can hear for Elena Kagan as she goes through the confirmation process. We'll be welcoming your phone calls as we always do. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org. Professor Lawrence Lessig is our first guest. He begins a piece that he wrote, a case for Kagan is the title. He began his career teaching at the University of Chicago Law School. And he writes that he was something of a slouch at that time when you compare him to some of his other colleagues. One of them was Elena Kagan. He says that he has, in making a case for Kagan, this case to make, that he's known her since they were both teaching together almost 20 years ago. They were the only two faculty beginning that year, and they became quick friends and allies. They shared a subscription to the opera. They conspired about how to build an even greater law school. And though she left to work for Clinton in 1995, they have remained close and constant friends. In the fall of 2008, she lured him back from Paradise, which was Stanford, to the Harvard Law School. I know her, I have known her, he says, as well as just about anyone else I have known in the legal academy. A perfect guest for us to have today because a lot of people say they don't know her very well. Thank you very much for being with us, Professor Lawrence Lessig. Nice to have you on the program.
Great to be here.
Why don't you talk a little bit more about how you've known her? That's quite a statement, that you know her as well as you know anybody else in the legal academy.
Well, you know, the University of Chicago was a pretty special place, and just to make sure that my slouch comment doesn't ricochet back on me too sharply, what I said in that was that compared to the other colleagues, which include Elena Kagan, Barack Obama, Judge Posner, Judge Easterbrook, Judge Diane Wood, Judge Michael McConnell, the place produced an extraordinary number of amazing leaders in the United States, and of course, I've not entered those ranks. So,
you're not too far away. I wouldn't demean yourself too much, Professor.
So at the University of Chicago for the 4 years that we were there together, there's a ritual of three times a week. The faculty, or at least a segment of the faculty, would have lunch together, called the round table. Sitting around a table, one conversation, some important legal issue, never sports, something salient to either politics or the law, and people would argue about it. One person would lead the conversation, everybody would follow. So over the course of those 4 years, I consistently got to see how she reacted to questions that both were important and were issues that I had very strong views on as well. And it's in that context that I, you know, believe I came to have a very solid understanding of who she is as a scholar and who she is as a person with enormously important and principled values.
You're right, and I think this is a tremendously difficult thing to do, particularly in this age of extreme partisanship. Kagan has had practical strategic experience. Her most important work over the past two decades has been in contexts when she has had to move people to see things as she did.
Right.
That's quite a feat.
Yeah, and no experience, I think, demonstrates that more clearly than what she did here at the Harvard Law School. I mean, when I left Chicago and came to Harvard in the late part of the 1990s, and then I left Harvard and went to Stanford in 2000, and she brought me back here just as she was leaving. And the Harvard that I came back to is a radically different place from the Harvard I left. And part of that was her ability to get what at the time was a very liberal law faculty to recognize the value and importance of a more diverse law faculty. Not because she herself was a Bush conservative. She's far from that. But because she recognizes that our students deserve the diversity of a legal education that allows them to understand a wide range of views and to make their own judgments about what's right. And in bringing the faculty to see that, she demonstrated an enormous skill in educating and convincing people of different views to come around to her view, not because she compromised in some sense. I mean, I'm definitely not a kind of Clinton triangulator. I don't think that's what anybody needs. But by convincing, and by convincing through respect and strength and building coalitions that can actually get something done. And I think this is a critical thing that liberals are missing about this appointment. We're not appointing the fifth justice. We're appointing the fourth justice. And what that means is we're appointing a justice who needs to be able to persuade the other side. And so, when I look at the candidates, I just recognize in Elena that extraordinary capacity, which is, I think, exactly why the president thought she was going to be such an important nominee.
And do you think, Professor Lessig, that given the makeup of this court and the fact that it's fairly predictable that any of the people who are considered to be on the conservative side of the court are open to that kind of solid persuasion?
I actually don't think it's true to say that they're predictable in the range of cases where this kind of persuasion is possible. First of all, there are principled surprises. Scalia is one of them. You know, I clerked for Scalia. I know him. I know his jurisprudence, and he often comes up with answers which surprise people from the simple kind of liberal conservative perspective. Because he has a consistent set of principles, or he tries to apply what he believes are a consistent set of principles, and sometimes they produce liberal results, sometimes they produce conservative results. And what somebody needs to do who wants to try to engage Scalia is to try to engage him on the basis of his principles and to see how to get those principles to lead to the answer that you want. And same thing with somebody like Justice Kennedy. I mean, obviously Justice Kennedy has enormous power on this court simply because he is the swing vote. We used to think of O'Connor as being the swing vote, but now it's Kennedy who's the swing vote. And what's clear about Justice Kennedy is you don't convince Justice Kennedy by coming in and loudly and being a loud, blustering, extremist about anything. You convince Justice Kennedy through calm, solid argument about why one view is the right view, and I think there's an enormous opportunity to get him to do the right thing in a whole bunch of cases where I know I think progressives would like to see him lead. For example, it is Justice Kennedy who has produced the most important advances for the recognition of rights against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, not because he's a liberal, but because he was persuaded by the value and the importance of the arguments that have ultimately prevailed in that area of jurisprudence.
Mm-hmm. You say that you have seen her flip the other side. Can you talk about cases in which she's been able to do that through her intellect, through her force of persuasion?
Well, when I said that, I was thinking, in particular about the experience I described before, this kind of, intense training ground of this lunch, roundtable lunch experience. But it's also evident in, what she did here. I think that the universal characterization of her work at the Harvard Law School by conservatives and liberals alike is that she broke a logjam in thinking. Got people who at one point said no, we're not going to have these people because we disagree with these people, to say, okay, we disagree with these people, but we are going to have these people, right? So she flipped in an important way how this university or this law school understood its mission. And that's no mean feat. The thing about law professors, they have tenure, they don't have any power in the world, which means they don't actually have to change their mind much. So if you succeed in changing their mind, this is a demonstration of enormous ability.
I'm sure she's going to be questioned very thoroughly by Republicans, and Bill Kristol in the Weekly Standard had an item on the website calling for her not to be confirmed. Her hostility to the U.S. military, he wrote, was enough to ask whether she would be an anti-military justice. Can you talk about that controversy on the Harvard campus and how likely she is to be hammered on this?
Yeah, I don't get that claim at all. So what happened was that Harvard Law School, like most law schools, has a very strong principle against discrimination, meaning if you are a law firm or if you're an employer who discriminates on the basis of sexual orientation or racial characteristics and sexual orientation, you will be denied the services of the Harvard Placement Center. Now, what that means is not that you'll be denied access to Harvard students or even denied access to Harvard facilities to hold your interviews, but that you'll be denied access to the scheduling software. That's basically what it is that allows students to sign up for your interviews. Well, the military, of course, has a discriminatory principle about gays in the military. Many people, including the president, many people in the military believe that discrimination is itself anti-military in the sense that there are gays and lesbians who want to serve their country who are told they're not allowed to because of this principle of discrimination. So consistent with that principle, she denied the access to the scheduling software for the military during the period of time when it was clear that principle was going to be applied in a way that was inconsistent with Harvard's standards. And at a certain point, it became clear that the rule was actually going to be upheld, and if it was upheld, Harvard was going to lose significant, close to $100 million in grants, and as a dean of a law school, she doesn't have the right to fritter away Harvard's money, so she was forced to back down from that. But the point that she was advancing was a point about non-discrimination, and the idea that the military is strengthened by discrimination is an idea which the President of the United States has expressly rejected. So I don't see why it's anti-military. It's anti-discrimination. Mm-hmm. And I understand if you're pro-discrimination, you could disagree with it and challenge it, but I don't think that this president should be or is pro-discrimination.
It already has become the dominant criticism of her. Do you imagine it will continue to be?
I think it's one. I think it doesn't have legs in the end. We're on a path to eliminating this discrimination, and she has one of the most striking things about her office as dean was she had a helmet from that was given to her when she gave a speech at West Point. This is one of her prized possessions, one of these beautiful decorative helmets that she kept right in the center of her office because the event where she spoke at West Point was one of the most moving and personally important events that she had as a dean. And she was enormously supportive of military students who are in the military, and there's a wide range of them who are now out there expressly talking to people about how important and supportive she was of that. So I think it takes a clumsy mind to confuse arguments against discrimination with arguments against the military. She wasn't anti-military. She was anti-discrimination.
You write in your piece, too many of our progressive colleagues swing for the bleachers of history rather than victories now, and you detail that. It's an interesting part of the piece.
Yeah, so I think that, there are justices on the Supreme Court, and again, Scalia and Thomas are examples, who think of their job as how to set an example of an extreme position, hoping the court will eventually catch up to it. And that's a fine strategy when you're the majority, because you can solidly count to five for your position, and if there are some who are pushing for a more extreme view of that position, then that's a good strategy for those who believe in that extreme view. But again, in this context, when we've got four justices on this side of the aisle, adding a justice who is the equivalent of Scalia or Thomas on the left is not going to actually win us cases. So what I'm interested in is making sure that the Supreme Court begins to articulate a set of doctrines that are correct, in my view, as interpretations of the Constitution and turn out to have a more progressive flavor to them than the increasingly extreme right-wing view that the Roberts Court has articulated. And so I think that takes a certain kind of humility in your work. You're not necessarily trying to write the case that is going to be the inspiration for 100 years of law students. You're trying to write the case that gets write the opinion that gets the right answer today. And that's the sensibility that I think the next justice on this court needs.
Hmm. Sometimes what we do in life, earlier in life, affects us for our whole lives. I'm wondering if she had that kind of experience clerking for Thurgood Marshall, who certainly is a giant in the Supreme Court history.
I think that's a good insight. And we should remember that Thurgood Marshall's own legal practice went through pretty important changes. The first stage of the NAACP's work to eliminate the effects of segregation was not to challenge segregation directly. Instead, what they argued was that the segregation rules mandated that the facilities be equal, separate but equal. So they originally were arguing for a much smaller point, which is just give us equal facilities. And after a while, it became clear that was impossible to deliver, and they took on the bigger challenge of destroying the doctrine of separate but equal. But it was after literally decades of work building to that particular position. And I think that recognized the importance of strategy in getting to the right answer, not the kind of naivete of just starting from the very first moment, screaming the right answer from the top of the bleachers. And I think that likely has, I mean, I hadn't thought about it like this, but I think it's a nice point, that likely has framed how she thinks about this work as well. You know, if she's confirmed, which I'm confident she will be, she's likely to serve on this court for 30 years. And when you sit in a court and you think, okay, for 30 years of my life I'm going to be working here, I want to develop a consistent set of doctrine that could begin to guide this court, that requires a long-term view as opposed to, the short-term exciting view that I think too many...
Excellent point. It is a long-term view,
yeah,
isn't
right.
it? Thank you so much for being with us and sharing your important insight, Professor Lessig.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Lawrence Lessig, a professor of law at Harvard Law School and co-founder of Change Congress, making a case for Eleni Kagan. He worked with her for a number of years. They began teaching 20 years ago. And as he says, he has known her as well as just about anyone else he has known in the legal academy. He began his career teaching at the University of Chicago Law School. And when he, in the article, says that he was something of a slouch, he says that facetiously because one of his colleagues became president of the United States, two were already prominent federal judges, two more would become federal appellate court judges, one would become the senior regulator at OMB, and one would become dean of the Harvard Law School and then Solicitor General of the United States, Eleni Kagan. We continue our conversation and we'll hear from somebody who believes that she's quite a blank slate here, and there's a lot we don't know about Eleni Kagan because she's never told us. Paul Campos will join us, professor of law at the University of Colorado, and we'll welcome phone calls for Professor. Our number is 800-486-8655. Your calls will be fine for all of our guests today, so call in whenever you'd like, and we'll weave your calls into this conversation. 800-486-8655. The email address, should you care to use that, is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Joining us now to talk about Eleni Kagan is Professor Paul Campos. He's a professor of law at the University of Colorado and wrote an intriguing piece in the New Republic, Blank Slate. There's a lot we don't know about Eleni Kagan because she has never told us. Feel free to join our conversation by phone or email during the course of this hour. Professor Campos, thank you so much for being with us.
Good to be here.
I think that this is an interesting, and I wonder how this is to her detriment. You write that various groups who respect her personally and professionally have projected their views onto her blank slate. Progressives believe she's a liberal, centrists assume she's a moderate, and conservatives say she isn't a bleeding heart. What is she?
We don't know. That's the problem. She has written very little. I've read all of her academic work, and she's written nothing for a general audience. So I've gone over everything that she's written outside of her attorney work product that she did as an associate general counsel for the White House. But everything else is available, and it doesn't really tell us anything about either her politics or her view of just about any significant legal issue, or for that matter, her beliefs about how judges ought to go about doing their job. And given that she's being put forward for a lifetime appointment on one of our most powerful institutions, I think that's a really serious problem.
What is the bulk of her academic work, if that's not too broad?
Well, she's written really in two areas. She's written some things on the First Amendment, and she's written a couple of pieces on administrative law. She's written about a half dozen articles, and they are very technical and largely confined to issues that don't tell us what we really need to know, which is, what does she think about the big stuff facing the Supreme Court going forward, and what does she think about how judges ought to go about interpreting constitutions, statutes, the law in general, and so forth. So it's very, I would say it's very cautious work. It's work that doesn't take chances either intellectually or politically, and it just isn't very useful in terms of the kinds of things that we would like to know when evaluating a candidate for the Supreme Court.
You do in the article say she has worked for two Democratic presidents, Clinton and Obama, and she has opposed Don't Ask, Don't Tell during debates over ROTC recruitment at Harvard. It is safe to say, you write, that Kagan's politics are left of center.
Yeah, I mean, it would be pretty astounding if she isn't actually a Democrat. I mean, we can sort of guess that that's the case, but Democrat is a very, very wide swath of the political landscape. I mean, Joe Lieberman is a Democrat, Russ Feingold is a Democrat. There's a huge amount of space in there, and we really don't know anything more than that. And in my view, that's just not enough.
What do we need to know?
Well, we need to know what she thinks about the big issues facing the American legal system at present. Just one example would be she argued as Solicitor General the Citizens United case 3 or 4 months ago. That's the case that involves the degree to which Congress can actually regulate corporate campaign spending. I'd like to know what is her own view on that, on how that case ought to have come out. Of course, when she was arguing that case as Solicitor General, she's representing a client, the United States government. So you can't attribute the arguments that she was making to the court as her own. They are, she's functioning in the role of a lawyer. I'd like to know, if she had been on the court, what would she have done? And I would bet a lot of money that she'll be asked that question in the confirmation hearings, and I would also bet a lot of money that she'll refuse to answer it.
Really?
Which I think is a really bad problem with our present system of evaluating Supreme Court nominees.
She would refuse to answer it for what reason?
Oh, well, there's this very subtle little sort of kabuki ritual that's been worked out by nominees, and it'll go something like this. She'll say, well, Senator, that's an excellent question, but I want to point out that there are a whole bunch of ancillary issues in regard to the matters brought up in Citizens United that are still unsettled that could come before the court, and it would just be wrong of me to comment on how I would come out on a future case which will be like Citizens United but not exactly like it. So all I can say is that it's a very difficult thing to balance the interest of free expression against those of keeping a good political process in place. So she'll say something like that, but she'll say it much more elegantly, but it's going to be essentially a dodge of the question that we would all like to know the answer to, which is, well, how would you have voted on that case?
She may surprise you, though, because certainly the president let us know and let the Supreme Court members know what he thought about it.
Sure, but he's already elected, right? So, yeah, but, maybe she'll surprise me. Especially, I mean, here there's a really striking irony, which is that one of the few, very few things of any substance that she said about the Supreme Court the whole political process surrounding the Supreme Court is she wrote a book review about 15 years ago, which was reviewing, among other things, the Clarence Thomas nomination hearings, and she she made some really rather tart comments about, and completely appropriate ones in my view, about how the Supreme Court nomination process had become a kind of a charade. And she said that, nominees should, in fact, have to answer the kinds of questions that they now routinely refuse to answer in regard to their legal views. I'm sure that's going to be pointed out to her repeatedly during her own confirmation hearings, and I have a sort of mordant fascination with how she's going to handle that, which is going to be a quite awkward, quotation for her to deal with.
Professor Campos, why do you think the president nominated her?
Well, I think that one problem is that we don't really know why, other than the sort of platitudinous things that he said about how smart she is and how she's a person who's supposedly going to take into account the social effects of legal decisions, although how he knows this, I'm not really sure. I think one other reason why he nominated her is because essentially I would say something that could be characterized as a sort of cronyism, really. I mean, he started on he was a member of the University of Chicago Law School faculty at precisely the same time that she was, so he knows her from way back. There's this, this kind of Ivy League cabal, essentially, now that pretty much decides who's going to end up in these kinds of positions. I mean, the absurdity of this has gotten to the point where this is the third straight nominee who's a Princeton undergraduate. Sotomayor and Alito, like Kagan, graduated from Princeton. I have nothing against Princeton, if we're talking about diversity, I mean, couldn't we at least have like a Cornell graduate or something at some point? it's getting so homogenous with these people with their resumes and their backgrounds that it's a little bit ludicrous, especially given the fact that what we do know about Kagan is relatively superficial: where she went to school, what kind of grades she got in law school, that she works really well with a diversity of people. These things do have relevance to being on the Supreme Court, but relatively marginal relevance. What's really relevant are what are her views on legal and political issues, and on this she remains an almost completely blank slate.
I'm looking today, one of my colleagues got a list of the Supreme Court justices without prior judicial experience before becoming justices, one of them William Rehnquist, but the list is amazing here: Abe Fortas and Lewis Powell and Byron Wright and William O. Douglas, Felix Frankfurter, Louis Brandeis. The list goes on and on. Did we have the same problem with all of them, too, that we didn't exactly know where they stood?
No. For the most part, most of those people had very well documented political and legal records, because with a couple of exceptions. I mean, Byron White is probably the closest case to Kagan. He was in the Kennedy Department of Justice, and he had been a lawyer, a private lawyer in Colorado before then. So he's probably the closest analogy to Kagan in this regard, and a very sobering one, given that he turned out to be a very center-right Democrat, pretty much the most conservative Democrat on the Supreme Court. Could be a cautionary tale for progressives and liberals there. But most of these other people had very extensive records of political and public service where their views were on the matters that we wanted to have information about were, for the most part, quite clear. That was certainly true in the cases of people like Frankfurter and Douglas and Brandeis. And so the fact that somebody hasn't been a judge, to me, is not in principle an objection to them being on the Supreme Court, but it does mean that that person has to leap, I think, a significant evidentiary bar in regard to demonstrating, what sort of judge exactly would you be? What are your beliefs, both in regard to politics and to law? And I don't think Kagan comes anywhere close to getting over that bar at this point.
And I share your concern that the Midwest and the West are neglected here.
Yeah, I mean, it really is getting to be a bit. I mean, there's an irony here, another irony as well, which I touched on in a piece I did for the Daily Beast yesterday. You know, in one sense, the court is more heterogeneous than ever. I mean, there are no WASPs on it for the first time ever. You know, you have six Catholics, three Jews, a couple of Italian-Americans, an African-American, a Latina. You know, it's an extremely diverse group in terms of those sorts of demographics. But in terms of educational and professional background, it's incredibly homogenous. You know, Kagan is supposed to be like a departure in these terms because she hasn't actually been a federal appellate judge. But the only difference between her resume and those of all the other people on the court right now is that her federal appellate judgeship in 1999 got shot down by Orrin Hatch. Otherwise, she'd have exactly the same background as all these other people. So if this is diversity, it's not a very stirring version of it.
Let's take some phone calls for you. Our number is 800-486-8655. Our guest this part of the show is Professor Paul Campos, professor of law at the University of Colorado. He's written a couple pieces. He's concerned about the nomination of Elena Kagan. Blank slate is the what we are looking at. He wrote a piece, he said, for the Daily Beast as well. This is in the New Republic, and it is titled Blank Slate. There's a lot we don't know about Elena Kagan because she's never told us. Jeff from Madison, hi.
Yes, good morning. I hear what your guest is saying. I found it a little disingenuous when, or not quite right on when you talked about her political affiliations and that she's probably a Democrat. Well, she's being appointed by President Obama, who is a Democrat, a representative of the Democratic Party, elected by many Democrats. Does anyone honestly believe that if George Bush had this chance that he would not have gone searching in the Republican ranks for a judge? I just find that a little off base. I'll listen off the air.
Okay, thanks, Jeff.
Well, there's an interesting analogy here, I think, with George W. Bush and Harriet Myers. Now, Kagan has got some significantly different qualifications from Myers in a lot of ways, but in one way, she's a similar kind of candidate in that essentially she doesn't have anything like the kind of public record on issues that she would want someone to have, just as Myers didn't. And the argument for Myers that was put forth by George W. Bush's supporters in regard to his nomination was, well, you know, George W. Bush is the head of the Republican Party, and we just need to trust his judgment on this kind of thing. And notice that movement conservatives absolutely did not go for that. They said, no way. You know, we got fooled on the Souter nomination, and we're not going to have that happen again. We're not going to go for a blank slate just because because we're supposed to trust the president. We don't think that's a good enough reason. I would personally like to see liberals and progressives take a similar attitude to this and to say, you know, just because Barack Obama says this is a good pick is not good enough for us.
Let me give you a couple emails here. Justice Roberts had a very small paper trail. He was appointed as Chief Justice. He said that he would call balls and strikes as a justice, but in fact, this is a very activist court overturning some nearly 100-year-old laws. Did his ability to be a stealth appointment trouble you then, and does it now?
Well, you know, I think the Roberts analogy is also interesting. He'd been a federal judge for, I believe, 2 or 3 years before he was appointed, so he did not have a long track record. However, his political affiliations were well known, and you know, he was, I think, a sort of clear case of someone whose ideology was sufficiently well delineated that the people who were supporting him had no doubts that he would be a certain kind of justice, or relatively few doubts. Personally, I think his claims about calling balls and strikes were just extremely disingenuous and a very misleading description of what a Supreme Court justice does. But it's the kind of thing that's politically palatable when you're in a nomination hearing. And unfortunately, I think we're going to hear similar things from Kagan, as indeed we did from Sotomayor.
And one more for you. This is from somebody in South Milwaukee. Your guest decries that we don't know anything about Elena Kagan, her politics or her views. Isn't that what we want in a judge? Someone who can not only be impartial, but who is perceived to be impartial. Isn't the ideology and very apparent politics of many of these already in the Supreme Court one of the problems with the court?
Well, I have to disagree with that. I mean, I just don't think that impartiality is something that is achievable or even desirable in the context of a Supreme Court justice. I mean, being a Supreme Court justice is an inherently political position. Deciding how the law to be interpreted at that level is, by its nature, a highly political act. It's not just a question, as Roberts claimed, of calling balls and strikes. It's much, much more complex and essentially just political all the way down than that, and that's why the politics of these justices are absolutely crucial in a way that's not that different, as I suggest in the New Republic piece, from the way that, for example, we would want to know what the politics of supporting for the Senate were before we voted for her. It would be really bizarre if a Senate candidate were to come forward who didn't really have any position on any public issues, but people said, well, she's really smart and a really good person and works well with other people, so we should vote for her, even if we don't really know what her position is on all kinds of important public issues. Nobody would ever accept anything like that in the context of a Senate candidate, and I don't believe we should accept it in the context of another somewhat related context, which is that of the highly political position of being a member of the United States Supreme Court.
Oh, I'd love to check in with you in a month from now or so. I hope you'll say yes.
Well, I'd like to.
Good. All right. Thank you. Thanks so much.
Yeah. Sure thing.
Our guest this part of the program, Professor Paul Campos, professor of law at the University of Colorado. Again, his piece is in the New Republic, Blank Slate, a lot we don't know about Elena Kagan because she has never told us. We're going to continue our conversation. Sam Stein has written a lot about the politics of this appointment and the battle that is ahead. He is a political reporter for the Huffington Post, and he'll join us momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sam Stein, political reporter for Huffington Post, is joining us now to look at how she's going to be questioned and perhaps why she was the one who was chosen. And we'll welcome phone calls, too. I know we have a lot of guests today, so it's difficult. But well, I'll get your calls in, as many as we can get, and also more of your emails, too. Our email address is talk@WPR.org. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Sam Stein, hi. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, this is interesting that one of the things that you've written about is that the Republican National Committee may be pressing her on the constitutionality of the recently passed health care law. I don't know what she would say about that, but is this going to be an issue that will go before the Supreme Court, do you think, Sam?
It's tough. I mean, you talk to some people and they think that these lawsuits that have been launched by various Republican attorney generals or attorneys general lack merit and that they will be easily dismissed. And looking at the legal arguments, I can understand why that is the case. But then you talk to some people who say there might be sympathetic judges out there and that this might actually be appealed all the way up to the Supreme Court in the end. Either way, the betting money is that these lawsuits don't end up overturning the law and that they are somewhat of a waste of resources and time. But it could very well go to the Supreme Court, and for that reason alone, you'll see a lot of Republican senators ask Elena Kagan about her thoughts on this, and as Kabuki Theater goes, you'll probably see Elena Kagan not answer those things, saying she can't prejudge.
Right.
But yeah, that's how it probably should play out.
Yeah. And how many of those questions, our previous guest talked about the fact that she really is a blank slate, and mm-hmm. he thought that she would take the same kind of response to other kinds of questions concerning campaign donations, et cetera. She can't talk about this. The court's going to take this up in the future. So, and that continues his perception of her as being a blank slate. Do a lot of people think that of her, that she is a blank slate?
Well, you talk to different people and you get different perceptions. Clearly, the one constant is that she's a brilliant academic mind, and there's no one who's really challenging her ability to understand and discuss the issues. The problem is you don't really get a sense of where she has discussed the issues. And so, yeah, she is a blank slate. I think that's fair to say. She's gone through an academic career writing very little about the key issues of the day, save a 2001 Law Review article on executive power. She had memorably a confrontation over Don't Ask, Don't Tell, where she barred military recruiters from the Harvard campus. And there's other things here and there in terms of First Amendment law, the stuff that I haven't really gone into all that in depth with my reporting, but she is a blank slate. I mean, that's part of her virtue in a way. You know, for better or worse, this is a political process, and presidents want to appoint someone who doesn't have a lot of controversial things on the record. And Elena Kagan is, first and foremost, someone without much controversy on her record, and it makes it a lot easier for the confirmation.
Considering where this court is now, that the conservative voice has been so dominant on a lot of major issues the past few years. Mm-hmm. If you get inside the president's head, do you think that he has to know that she is going to be, if you can use this word, liberal and conservative, she will be a liberal jurist?
Yeah, I mean, there is a sense when you talk to people privately in the White House that they say to you, and this is always, of course, off record and or on background, they say, well, of course she's a liberal, of course she's a Democrat. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence to suggest such. She worked in the Clinton White House. She comes from predominantly Democratic communities. She's worked in predominantly Democratic environments. It would be fair guess to suggest that she is a liberal. The problem, of course, is that you're dealing with a lifetime appointment. And as several previous appointees have proven, when you send someone to the court without a clear understanding of their jurisprudence, oftentimes you can be disappointed or shocked. I mean, David Souter is a great example of this. Republican appointed, ended up being a very reliable liberal vote on the court. And so there's a heap of concern among progressives about this. But when you ask the White House about these questions, they say, in essence, trust us. You know, we know where she stands on these issues. She'll be good on these issues. And, you know, you have to believe in the fact that the president wouldn't want to appoint someone, for instance, who would overturn Roe v. Wade.
Mm-hmm. The big issue, of course, has been this, whether or not she's going to be, as you wrote, Bill Kristol making mention in Weekly Standard, is she going to be this anti-military justice? You can hear it happening already.
That is the attack line. And I think when I talked to a few Republican operatives and officials yesterday for another article I wrote, and they seem to think that that's the area of greatest vulnerability for Solicitor General Kagan. Not only is it, primarily it's tied to her treatment of military recruiters at the Harvard campus, a very principled stance in defense of the rights of gays to serve in the military that she ultimately backed down when pressure came that Harvard would be denied federal funds if they barred military recruiters. There's nothing, I think, in her record that suggests she's anti-military. I think that's hyperbole in the worst sense of the word. In fact, the same Bill Kristol almost endorsed her, essentially, a couple months ago, primarily because she had this theory of the unitary executive that was very much in line with how he viewed the war on terror. And so, you know, there's a bit of a contradiction there. You can't, at one hand, laud Elena Kagan for saying she deferred or granted the president the rights to, you know, put detainees in a military tribunal or anything along those lines, and at the same token, say that she's anti-military. It just doesn't work side and side. So, but that being said, I'm guessing that you'll see a heap of criticism over what she did with military recruiters at Harvard, in part because that's one of the only areas in which she's really come out with a very firm political position on one of the key issues of the day.
Considering we live in an age of television, from what I have read about her, she is considered to be absolutely brilliant and can persuade a room to her area mm-hmm. of thinking, that she's a real dominant force, and I would imagine that will come through.
Yeah, and that's that. I did an earlier article. This is sort of a fun piece about how she had she's the community from where she comes is you know, filled with academic and judicial elites, having been dean of Harvard Law School. And one of the things that sort of stood out was how much or how easily she worked with conservatives. I mean, she wrote endorsement letters or signed endorsement letters for two of the two controversial Bush appointees to the court, and she was reciprocated with endorsement letters of her own by people like Miguel Estrada, another controversial Bush appointee. And I talked to one person about it and said, well, what does this tell us about Elena Kagan? And essentially what it said is, you know, this is someone who works very well across the ideological aisle. She can be persuasive, but she can also be a good listener. And in all likelihood, if she were to end up on the court, it's someone who would work as the fifth vote, the person who decides the majority of the cases, because she fancies herself someone who, you know, is post-ideological, post-political, and is also quite persuasive, as you meant, as you mentioned. So, you know, you're reading the tea leaves here because you don't have too much to go on, but I think that's a valid interpretation of her character.
One of our guests earlier, Professor Lessig from Harvard, who had taught with her and said he knows her better than anybody else in the legal community, said that her position on the court would be somewhat different in that through the force of her intellect and her personality, he sees her as being able to lay out the case for some issue, and because she's so brilliant with this and so persuasive, she will be able to move people to her position.
And that's that may very well be true. Larry does know her better than probably anyone, save her closest colleagues. And, you know, everyone who I talk to who's worked with her or dealt with her says she's incredibly persuasive, has an unbelievable grasp of the legal issues of the day, and can talk about it in a way that is alluring in some respects. And so, yeah, I mean, that is a huge advantage for anyone on the court. I mean, what's happening, we have to put it in the right context, right? John Paul Stevens was the major progressive voice on the court. He was sort of the ideological compass for that side of the court. What you're replacing him with now is someone who, if Kagan is to be confirmed, someone who probably isn't the same, built from the same mold, but is someone who will work with others and try to persuade them rather than staking out a firm ground and leveling arguments that he or she believes are, you know, correct judicial philosophy.
Let's welcome a couple phone calls in the minutes we have left. 800-486-8655. Sam Stein is our guest, political reporter for Huffington Post, and he's written extensively in the last few days about Kagan. He writes about other things as well, but that's what we're talking about right now. Kelly from Marshfield. Hi, Kelly.
Hi, nice to be with you.
Nice to have you here.
My question is this. It seems like with female judicial nominees, we're very quick to question their intellectual prowess. I heard even last night one conservative pundit refer to her as, you know, she's no Scalia, and really questioning if she had this sort of intellectual chops to kind of hang with the big boys on the Supreme Court, even though her resume is very similar to those who currently serve on the Supreme Court right now. So I'm wondering if you noticed that. I noticed it with Sotomayor. I did not notice it with Justice Roberts or Justice Alito. It's really, you know, this questioning so soon of if they have the intellectual prowess, you know, because they're a female. Is this criticism even warranted? Do you notice this? I guess that's my question.
I'll take that one step further. Remember what happened with Harriet Myers, the Bush appointee, whose intellectual prowess actually was the reason for her withdrawal as a nominee, or questions of, sorry, I should say. You know, I think you're right to point out that there are, you know, there's a pattern here where a woman is appointed and there's immediately questions about her intellectual prowess. But with Elena Kagan, what we've talked about so far on this program, at the very least, you know, no one is doubting it. I mean, there might be partisan-driven questions about it, but I think a resume such as hers sort of alleviates any concern that she lacks the intellect for the court. It's more of a question of does she have the requisite experience.
Thank you very much for your call, Kelly. Our number is 800-486-8655. How tough a battle? Both our other guests said that they believe that she will be confirmed. How tough a battle is brewing right now, Sam?
Oh, I would have to probably agree with your earlier guests, although, you know, there might be something in that record, not a wise Latina comment like Sotomayor, but something that could, you know, throw this all to the wind. But you know, she's someone who was picked, I would guess, first and foremost, because she would be easily confirmed. I mean, not only has she gone through a vote very recently for the Solicitor General, but, you know, like we mentioned, she doesn't have a resume that's filled with controversial stances. She's incredibly persuasive. She's has a history of bringing, you know, partisan camps together. It's the type of nominee who, you know, is tailor-made for a confirmation process. And so I would gather that the Republican Party will, you know, throw a good fit over it, as they should do and as they will do. But in the end, expect a healthy healthy majority for her nomination.
And when you look historically at other nominees who may have had similar kind of experience to her, not being on the bench, is there somebody who immediately comes to mind? We were talking about Byron Wright, one of our guests, lamenting the fact that he was too much of a right Democrat and a bit of a disappointment. Are there others who sort of have anything that's similar to what she's got?
I'm doing actually a piece on this now because the resume question is sort of popping up among criticisms of her. You would say Thurgood Marshall, but he had more political experience, and a bunch of people have commented that in today's system, he probably wouldn't be confirmed for his resume. One of the things that sort of pops up at me is William Rehnquist, the fabled
yes.
conservative justice who was chief of the Supreme Court before he died. You know, he had a very slim resume. It actually is, it's remarkable for how slim it is. He was in private practice in Phoenix. Prior to that, he clerked on the court, and then he was an assistant USAG in the Office of Legal Counsel before he was appointed to the Supreme Court. No one actually remembers how thin that resume is by today's standards, and you contrast that with Kagan's, and it's remarkable. But he was also someone who, like Kagan, sort of was a well-respected lawyer within his party circles. He had worked in a White House. He had clerked on the Supreme Court. He had private practice experience. She had academic experience. But, you know, that's the type of template, I think, that actually holds up best because, again, you're dealing with someone who never was a judge. In recent history, you know,
right.
every president's barred from the Court of Appeals for their Supreme Court pick. So, you know, I think the Rehnquist comparison actually works a little
mm-hmm.
bit.
We'll look forward to your continuing articles. Thanks, Sam. Thanks for being with us.
Come read the site.
We will. Okay. We do all the time. Sam Stein, political reporter for Huffington Post. Thanks so much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this really interesting hour. Chrissy Pease for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks for being involved in the show. We'll return following the news.